The circus, place of dreams, hopes, and healing.
At one point in the story, Daniel gets involved with a circus, and there are six dancing ponies that perform with the circus, and their master has fled and has been a very abusive master. So Daniel is given the responsibility of taking care of these ponies, and he decides he wants to retrain them and try to erase the fear that they have had from the abuse. And so he's working on mending the ponies, and there's actually a scene in the story where he's told by the owner of the circus, well, these horses are broken. Why do you have to do anything with them? They're already trained. They're already broken. And Daniel says, yeah, they're broken, and I'm mending them.
That's Michelle Barker. We talk with her about her new book, Mending Horses. It's a sequel to her wonderful first historical novel, A Difficult Boy. And then Ellen Bryson takes P.T. Barnum's first circus as the setting to explore the freak in all of us.
I like to go back to think about what it feels like to be an other. I think we're fascinated with the other because in some horrifying place inside of us, we are that person who is separate from everyone else. You know, I think there's a kind of resonating connection there.
Ellen Bryson's novel is The Transformation of Bartholomew Fortuno. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rianna. We first came across M.P. Barker's wonderful fiction when she came out with her novel for middle readers, A Difficult Boy. Set in early 19th century New England, it was about two young indentured servants who make common cause against an abusive master. We spoke with her in 2008. Now, the main protagonist of A Difficult Boy, the young Irish immigrant Daniel Linehan, is back in a sequel. It's called Mending Horses, and it follows our young hero as he sets out, freed from servitude, on a perilous new life with his beloved horse Ivy. Along the way, he meets up with two fellow outcasts, a roving peddler and a child fleeing an abusive father. Their journey together ends up mending each other's broken lives as they heal a circus's mistreated horses. M.P. Barker wields her eloquent pen to explore themes of abuse, justice, and healing. A former historical interpreter for Old Sturbridge Village, Barker's talent for bringing the past alive, as well as her lively plot lines, make her books a fascinating treat to read. Michelle Barker, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This was just a wonderful book. It's a sequel to A Difficult Boy, which we spoke to you about several years ago. We start out this book with a now 16-year-old Daniel Linehan. He's a former indentured servant in the pre-Civil War New England. He's now free, and he's getting into some difficult circumstances as the book opens. First, tell us about Daniel and bring us up to date on his story.
Okay, well, Daniel is an Irish boy who was orphaned, and that was how he got into indentured servitude. And the first book concluded as he was freed from indentured servitude and received his walking paper, so to speak, and also a horse that he really, really loved named Ivy. And so as the second book, Mending Horses, opens, Daniel is on his own for the first time in his entire life and has no clue what to do. And in New England in the 1830s, the Irish were often looked upon with suspicion. And so he's traveling by himself with this lovely horse. And so immediately people think that he's stolen the horse, he's stolen anything that he's brought with him, and that immediately gets him into trouble.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give away the plot lines because they're pretty integral to the suspense of the novel. But we can, I think, probably say that he does eventually get rescued. But tell us about what he what this character is like. I mean, he has suffered a huge amount of abuse in his life. Why did he do that? What have been the circumstances and his responses to them?
Well, his circumstances initially as an indentured servant were that he was basically in the position of almost a temporary sort of slavery, so that the master of an indentured servant had quite a lot of rights over him. And if the master chose to be abusive, there wasn't a lot of recourse. And so the situation that he was in initially as an indentured servant was quite a difficult and quite an abusive one because he had a bad master. And in the time period, because the Irish were looked on as very inferior, that was sort of some of the justification for that abuse. And the way that he dealt with a lot of it was to retreat into taking care of this horse. And so he built up this very strong bond with Ivy. And that was really the only time in his life that he could be free. And so that was, and eventually became kind of the essence of his character, was to become this sort of self-taught horse whisperer. And that was his way of dealing with the abusive situation that he had grown up in.
It's interesting because the contemporary horse whisperer, I've forgotten his name, but there's a movie about him. He also had a very abusive home life, and he was able to translate his sympathy, his empathy for the horses, into developing a whole different way of dealing with them. And that's very central, that kind of idea is very central to your title. Could you tell us a little bit more in depth about the differing layers of your title, Mending Horses?
And you're mentioning Monty Roberts, I think, is probably the horse whisperer you're talking about. And I did a lot of reading of his books to try to develop the horse whispering aspect of the story. But Mending Horses has a lot of meanings. The most obvious meaning is that at one point in the story, Daniel gets involved with a circus. And there are six dancing ponies that perform with the circus, and their master has fled and has been a very abusive master. So Daniel is given the responsibility of taking care of these ponies, and he decides he wants to retrain them and try to erase the fear that they have had from the abuse. And so he's working on mending the ponies, and there's actually a scene in the story where he's told by the owner of the circus, well, these horses are broken. Why do you have to do anything with them? They're already trained. They're already broken. And Daniel says, yeah, they're broken, and I'm mending them. So, you know, he kind of takes the literal interpretation of the words broken and mending. But at the same time, the horses are mending Daniel and also mending other characters in the story. The characters in the story have a lot of damage in their lives, a lot of broken lives. And so they are kind of mending each other's lives as the horses are being mended. And there's sort of a back and forth between the ability of the humans to kind of heal the horses and the ability of these animals and the work that the humans are doing with the animals to heal the humans in the story.
And there's another major character, a young person named Billy. Tell us about him and his relationship to another horse.
Okay, yeah, Billy's a runaway. Because Billy had grown up in, Billy's Irish as well, had grown up in the sort of paddy camps. These were these areas in mill towns where the Irish were kind of relegated to live in these little shanties. And Billy's dad was an alcoholic and abusive. And so Billy runs away from the situation. And Billy has a particular talent as well. Billy is just a wonderful singer. And when Billy runs away from the abusive father, Billy runs across this peddler who has this really kind of bizarre-looking, broken-down-looking horse, but who's very sweet. And Billy kind of falls in love with this horse and ends up trying to steal the horse from the peddler. The peddler ends up kind of taking Billy under his wing, and Billy and the peddler join up with Daniel, and they work together in the circus. But Billy's very hostile. Billy's very combative and confrontational because of the situation of being with this abusive father. And so Billy is kind of tamed through the story as Billy works with Daniel and the horses, and the peddler kind of becomes this father figure to Billy.
And this is a peddler that we've met in your first book as well, A Difficult Boy. That is Jonathan Stocking. Tell us about him and also about the position of the Yankee peddler. What did you find out about the peddlers?
Well, the peddler character came out of some research that I did when I worked at Old Sturbridge Village. We were trying to develop an interpretive program so that one of the or several of the employees working at the village could play the role-playing part of a peddler going through the village and selling various goods. And the peddler was kind of an important character in New England villages because he would bring news from one village to the next, would kind of bring the gossip around, would bring new things into the community. And it was a job that was often done by young men who were kind of at the start of trying to decide what they wanted to do as a career. And they would work on peddling and just, you know, see how they liked it and maybe would eventually go into business as a storekeeper or something like that. Or maybe they decide they didn't like it and go into something completely different. So Jonathan Stocking is a little bit different from that mold in that he's in his 50s and is doing this work kind of late in life. But he's kind of a natural-born itinerant, kind of a natural-born wanderer. He's done every single kind of roaming job that you could have done in New England in the time period. They were often traveling dancing masters and singing masters. Actors often were in traveling companies, and he's done all of that. He's sort of a jack-of-all-trades as long as the trade involves traveling. And he's never really settled down in his life and has found himself thrust into this role of a father figure and a little bit uncomfortable about how to do it, but kind of instinctively handles it very well.
Yeah, he's a very sympathetic character, and he doesn't seem to have a lot of the prejudices of the society around him. One of the things that's very, you know, particular is this anti-Irish prejudice. Was New England particularly anti-Irish, and why were the Irish so targeted?
It was pretty strong throughout the country. I mean, New England was probably strongest because it was getting the biggest influx of Irish, at least Irish Catholic. I mean, the prejudice was primarily against the Irish Catholics. And that prejudice goes back hundreds of years to the history that the English and the Irish had. And of course, America, particularly New England, was settled by English-descended folks. And they carried that prejudice with them even after America had split off from England. And so there was this idea that the Irish were inferior, that they were very superstitious, that their Catholic beliefs were very inferior, and that they were sort of ruled by this popery, by the Pope, who was this outside figure. And that was often very feared in the time period. And so you find a lot of writing about the Irish that is really, really shocking in the types of language that you see being used. And it's kind of similar to the type of racist language that you might have heard against African Americans, for example, or other folks who are, you know, not the typical WASP people. So it was a very, very strong and very historically based prejudice that was pretty ingrained in the culture.
What were the notions about the Irish that were so shocking to you as you read this?
You know, I'd kind of been aware of a lot of this prejudice, but, you know, having to read it very closely to write the story and to research the story, I think what surprised me was how little some things had changed over time. It's just that the particular ethnic group that was despised tended to change, but the language stayed the same. And what is surprising, too, is that you oftentimes think of white on black or white on brown or white on Asian prejudice, and you don't think as much of white on white prejudice these days. But it was certainly very, very strong in the 19th century through the 20th century. And that, even though I know in the back of my head that exists, to really see it on paper in a news article or in somebody's letter or somebody's essay from the time period is always kind of jarring.
I understand that there was even an idea that the Irish were not white.
Yes, that's often, I'm trying to think of a way to put it that's not going to be offensive, but people were often describing the Irish as in the same language as they would describe African Americans and use the N-word. Talking about the Irish.
The other big theme, and we've, you know, touched on it already, is child abuse, which seems very intertwined with the class relations, poverty in these novels. You know, I think a lot of Americans think that the yeoman farmer in early New England was a very democratic society, but it does not come across as democratic in your novels, in A Difficult Boy and Mending Horses.
Well, it is and it isn't, I suppose. If you were, you know, white of Anglo-Saxon descent, you know, especially if you were a Congregationalist, you know, the sort of the majority Protestant, things were, you know, somewhat egalitarian. I mean, you certainly did have the differences in people's financial situations that placed them in different classes, but, you know, certainly wasn't as distinctive as you might find in Europe. But when you get to someone who's of a different ethnic background, of a different race, of a different religion, then bets are sort of off in terms of equality. So you find the Irish living in these paddy camps, which are basically shanty towns made of construction refuse that was left over from building the mills. You find that the way people referred to folks of a different ethnic background was not only prejudice, but also sometimes did have something of a classist air to it. Yeah, that's true. But in terms of things like child abuse, which you brought up, I think it's just a part of the culture of the time period that corporal punishment was pretty well tolerated at many, many levels of society, whether you were poor, middle class, upper class, that the types of punishment that we think of as extreme were considered fairly run-of-the-mill, and you had to get really, really extreme for somebody to consider behavior as being abusive. That started to change in Victorian times. So the time period of the two novels, which is 1839, is just kind of at the turning point when those attitudes about children were starting to change, but they hadn't quite changed yet.
So the attitudes were actually beginning to change. Is this something that you found in the popular press, or where did you find this?
Well, a lot of times you'd find it in advice literature of the time period. So you would find, you know, advice books for mothers, advice books for families would talk about children in a much gentler light as the century progressed and would talk less in terms of physical punishment and more in terms of other types of punishment. Although, you know, certainly most folks my age and older probably still remember corporal punishment being somewhat tolerated as we were growing up as well.
So now back to the book Mending Horses, Michelle Barker. Your characters join a circus, and I just found such a rich historical load of information in the description of the circuses. It's not called a circus. Talk about the circuses of New England of this time. Give us the whole flavor of them.
Well, that was a really fun thing to research. There's this great museum in Summers, New York, the Museum of the Early American Circus, and I spent a lot of time there going over their archives and a lot of publications from the time period to try to figure out what a circus was like in that time. And it was at a time when the circus was just starting to become what we think of as a circus today. In New England, there were a lot of laws against traveling performers and things like circuses, either completely prohibiting them or requiring very expensive licensing fees. And so you might find that, as the circus in the story does, that some of these traveling shows would call themselves something different so that they could get around some of those laws. So the circus in the story calls itself a museum. You might also find that menageries would be traveling around and would focus on the educational aspect of seeing the animals in captivity rather than the entertainment aspect of it. You'd often see advertisements for traveling shows talking about the educational value of the show and also emphasizing that the show was moral and chaste and that all of the acts were suitable for young ladies to see and for children to see. But initially, in, say, the 18th century, the acrobats and the equestrian acts and the menageries were very often completely separate shows. So you didn't have the circus that combined all of those things. What was considered a circus in the 18th century was primarily equestrian acts, so performing horses and trick riders and that sort of thing. And it's not until the 1820s and 30s that you start to see those performing horses being combined with the menagerie act and being combined with the acrobats and starting to evolve into that combination of all of these different wonderful performers that you see now in circuses. And so the format was just starting to take shape and really hadn't been solidified yet at that time period. So you find that circuses might include opera singers. They might include these panoramas of various historic events. They might include theatrical performances, you know, scenes from Shakespeare and things like that. Lots of things that we don't think of as belonging in a circus today.
Another historical development that is introduced in your book is the railroad. So is this really where it was beginning to be laid?
Yes. In 1839, the railroad was just coming into this part of the state. So I got very lucky. I hadn't realized when I was writing the story that 1831 was the exact year when the railroad came to Springfield and actually came at a very auspicious date in my story. I was able to fit the celebration of the coming of the railroad into a scene in the story because it came right in the exact time that I wanted it to, and I hadn't anticipated that at all. That was really fun. But the railroad was really changing New England, and, you know, getting the railroad into your town was going to make or break your town. And it was also bringing in many, many more Irish workers because they were the ones who were laying the track and, you know, cutting out the mountains, lowering the hills or raising the valleys or whatever they needed to do to bring the railroad across the state. So that was really fascinating to read about, and something that I wish I had been able to include more of, but that would have probably bogged the story down a little bit.
Michelle Barker, and other wonderful aspect of this book, Mending Horses, is the multiple points of view that you use. You have marvelous development of your characters, several young people. You have the circus master, who's quite a character in his own right. I'd like to ask you a little bit about the writing from these multiple points of views. Was that a challenge?
It was a big challenge because I hadn't done that before. In A Difficult Boy, the story stays in one character's point of view, and most of the writing that I had done in terms of short stories or other things that I had written that hadn't been published had been from a single point of view. So this was the first time that I had really done a lot with several points of view, and I think I have 4 or 5 points of view in the story. So it was a challenge to make the voices sound different. You know, I tried very hard to make Mr. Stocking sound different from Billy and different from Daniel. And had to really concentrate on those characters and try to get in their head to make sure that the language they were using fit with the age of the character, with the background of the character. And took a lot of rewriting and playing around with the characters and helped me get to know them better, I think, by taking each character's point of view.
Were there tricks that you used to do that? I mean, did you find that you could actually, you know, put yourself right inside the character?
Thinking about it, almost as a monologue or a dialogue with the character. You know, the character either having a monologue or me having a dialogue with the character helped so that I could try to think about the character's speaking voice. And that helped me kind of get into the character's head and get the words right and the syntax right. You know, almost as if I was quizzing the character or as if the character was narrating his own story, even though it's not told in the first person. You know, each character's point of view was told in kind of a limited third-person point of view, I still had to imagine in my head as if the character were speaking directly to me. And I think that's what helped me get the voice right.
And how could you make sure that you weren't, you know, getting into anachronistic language? How did you get into the language of the time itself?
Well, reading a lot from the time period certainly helps to get the language and the syntax right. And we did a lot of that type of reading when I worked at Old Sturbridge Village in the training materials. We read a lot of diaries, we read a lot of letters, a lot of contemporary publications, and I continued to do that as I was doing the research. But even so, my copy editor did catch a couple of words that were anachronistic and fortunately saved me from a couple of faux pas. For example, there's a word kerfuffle that I used a couple of times, which sounds like a wonderful old-fashioned 19th century word. And turns out that it wasn't used until, I think, the 1930s or the 1940s.
Another theme in the book, Mending Horses, is very much the difference between how people see themselves and how they are viewed by society, by others, and how they struggle against those limitations. I mean, I think that's true in any society. So that's really a theme in this book as well. I mean, you have gender issues with one of the characters who's seen as one thing but is something else. As we pointed out with Daniel, he's looked down upon because he's Irish. And there's even an African-American who makes brief appearances, but who brings a different perspective. Is this a theme that you are working with consciously?
Yeah, I think so. I think it started when I brought the character of Billy into the story and I realized that Billy had this secret. And I didn't want Daniel to be someone who would have a 20th century or 21st century attitude towards Billy and Billy's issues. So that was what started it. You know, I wanted Daniel to have a real 19th century attitude and to have to be made to think about his own prejudices. You know, he's faced prejudice, but he has his own prejudices. So I wanted him to have to face that. And I think as I worked with Daniel doing that, sort of the issues the other characters had that paralleled that sort of evolved from there. So you've got, you know, Mr. Stocking, who sees himself as this roving character who really can't settle down. You know, he's got some self-worth issues, I think. You know, certainly doesn't think of himself as being a good father figure and finds out that he is, and he has this real talent for being wise and for giving guidance. So I think the issue not only of society's perceptions of people being erroneous, but also people's perceptions of themselves being erroneous sort of evolved from initially the core issue of Daniel's perceptions. And then that worked into the other characters as well, kind of paralleling that.
And there's another character, I mean, a minor one, but, you know, who is an independent woman, but she is a prostitute. I mean, in other words, the only way, you get the sense the only way she could be independent in that society would be to take on that profession.
Well, it's partly because of her having had an illegitimate child and was an issue that she did not want to lay at her family's doorstep, and so she basically ran away. And so someone in that situation would certainly have a difficult time finding a job, finding references, that sort of thing. And so that's how she ends up turning to prostitution. There certainly were some women who were able to support themselves independently in the time period without having to do that. But it was certainly difficult because women's work was financially valued so low compared to men's work. You know, you could be a school teacher, but you'd be paid a lot less than a man, even a man who was doing the same job as you were doing. You could work in a factory, but again, you'd make less than a man would, although factory work was probably one of the better paying jobs that a woman could get in the time period. But yeah, it certainly was much more difficult for a woman to be independent and make her own living in that time period than it would be for a man.
So this is young adult historical fiction, although I found it a terrific read for any age. Why have you picked this genre?
I think the genre kind of picked me. I didn't intentionally, with either A Difficult Boy or Mending Horses, set out to write young adult fiction. I set out to write a story about a couple of characters that really interested me, and I thought I was writing for anybody. I thought I was writing for adults, actually, and then when I started to market A Difficult Boy and try to find a publisher, the editors who did respond to my queries kept saying, no, this isn't, you know, an adult book, this is a young adult book, or this is a middle grade book, or whatever, and you should send it to a different kind of publisher, or you should send it to a different kind of agent. And so what happened was that the publisher that decided to take on the book was a publisher of middle grade and young adult fiction. And since Mending Horses is the sequel, of course, it ended up in the same genre. But for me, I feel like it's a book that is for all ages, as you said. And I've had really great readership among adults for A Difficult Boy, and I certainly hope to have great readership among adults for Mending Horses, as well as among young adults.
Yeah. And is there a sequel to this? Is this going to be a trilogy?
Right now, I don't know. I'm working on a third book, but it's completely different. It's takes place still in New England in the 19th century, but doesn't have anything to do with Daniel or the other characters in Mending Horses or A Difficult Boy. So we'll see if I come back to these characters when I finish this other book.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed the book, and I've been thoroughly enjoyed speaking with you today, Michelle Barker. Your newest book is Mending Horses. It's a sequel to A Difficult Boy. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Michelle P. Barker is also the author of two nonfiction historical books. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Mending Horses and also to hear our interview with her about the first book, A Difficult Boy. Next up, we keep with the early American circus theme. We talk with Ellen Bryson about the transformation of Bartholomew Fortunio. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Ellen Bryson came out with her debut novel, The Transformation of Bartholomew Fortunio, I was intrigued because it takes place in P.T. Barnum's first American museum, the name he gave his circus in New York City. In 1865, the museum burned down, the target of arsonists, and Barnum built a new museum a little further north on Broadway. I happen to now live on the site of that building, which also burned down. P.T. Barnum's abolitionist views were unpopular in New York City. Bryson's novel richly satisfied my historical curiosity with its descriptions of Barnum's museum and its performers. Her novel, The Transformation of Bartholomew Fortunio, centers on two of those performers, the Thin Man and the Bearded Lady, and the unlucky romance between them. I spoke with Ellen Bryson back in 2010, but somehow never found the right spot to air the interview, until now. In the intervening years, my mother, whose Broadway loft was built on the site of the second P.T. Barnum Museum, passed away, and I have taken her place there. Ellen Bryson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
Now, this is your first novel, The Transformation of Bartholomew Fortunio. It's a kind of a curious subject. How did you get interested in P.T. Barnum's circus? Actually, it predates his circus.
It does.
His American Museum, although I think that was really his biggest installation, wasn't it?
The circus or the museum?
The museum.
It was. He's most famous now for the circus, but he didn't really become a circus empresario until he was 61. So he was essentially a collector of odd items, and even more important than that, he was really the precursor of building modern culture.
Wow, that's a huge.
He was amazing. I mean, I feel that strongly about him. There was no such thing as common places for all sorts of people to go. I mean, entertainment was quite limited and quite personal. You could go to the bars and you could go to the small, they wouldn't be called nightclubs, but theaters. Most of it was pretty low. Or you could go to the upper end and symphonies and certain kinds of plays. But what Barnum did was create a place for basically all of New York City to come together and enjoy themselves. And he was a huge promoter of things. And prior to Barnum, promotion wasn't really on the public scene.
So he was like the first impresario?
Absolutely.
Huh.
And, as far as I'm concerned.
And you're saying he kind of invented entertainment for the masses.
That's what I'm saying. And it was mostly about promotion. I mean, he had so many wonderful hoaxes, and people knew that he was hoaxing them, and enjoyed the fact that he was. For example, he had this thing called the Fiji Mermaid. He's still quite famous for, and he basically claimed that this thing was the most gorgeous creature in the world. He hired his friend to pretend that he was a professor who had discovered the Fiji Mermaid. And in fact, what it was nothing but a constructed, really quite ugly body of a fish, and on top was sewn the head of a monkey. But the illustrations that he would do would be of this beautiful woman with a long, you know, with a long, sleek body. And he was just known for these kinds of things.
And so what would happen when people came into the American Museum and found this monkey sewn onto the body of a fish?
Well, first they paid to see it, which, of course, was his goal. And then they laughed because they knew that he was duping them. And it built word of mouth, and the crowds are huge.
And what kind of a character was he?
I've kind of demonized him in the book. I've made him a little more wicked than maybe he was. I mean, it's very hard to know. He was obviously an exceptionally hard worker. But, you know, I found this photo of P.T. Barnum, and he's sitting in a little opera box. And it's obviously staged, but outside on the stage itself, he's looking at is this little ballerina, and he has the most leering look on his face, and it's really awful. And you know, that it was that Barnum that I built on. I mean, there's no way to know who the man actually was. He was, he wrote his own autobiography, but that was so pompous in a way and full of what he wanted to project. But he was mayor of Bridgeport, Connecticut for a while, so he was interested in politics. He was a number of things.
Yeah, and now you mentioned a photograph. A photograph inspired this book. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, a dream inspired this book, and it was years ago, and I had a dream. I woke up startled in the middle of the night. I had a dream of, I saw in a circus tent, it was probably like 1940s, that era, that kind of sepia-toned quality to the dream. And under the circus tent, there were seven sisters. There were six or seven, I don't remember anymore. And they were standing in like a horseshoe, and they were looking up into the spotlight, calling out their names. And one of them was Ael, who's one of the major characters. And I don't really remember the rest of the names, but they all had these huge, beautiful beards. And in the dream, it was so peculiar to me because in the dream, you know, these women were gorgeous. And I woke up and I was startled and I thought, well, how in the world can a woman with a beard be beautiful? Who's going to perceive that? How can one imagine even? And from there, my protagonist came to me and, you know, I hit the internet and started looking for pictures of women with beards. And it was supposed to be her story. The bearded woman's story, but I ended up searching desperately for a person who could explain how gorgeous she was, and the only person that made any sense to me was somebody else with a peculiarity, with an odd body, because they had to share the same perspective.
And so you created this character, Bartholomew Fortuno, the living skeleton.
Correct. Now, there was someone named Isaac Sprague who had billed himself as a living skeleton in the same time period in Barnum's Museum. So he was based visually on this other character. But there was, you know, there's literally nothing known about people who, or very little known about people who showed themselves at that time. And, you know, except for the fact that the freaks in Barnum's, working for Barnum, were treated extraordinarily well, and they had compared to others much longer and much more productive careers.
So he treated, you're saying he was kind of a good boss.
Well, I'm saying that from what little research I could find on the freaks that worked for him, they weren't beaten, they weren't tossed out after a year. A lot of it's imagined on my part.
So in a way, I mean, what you're saying here really is that he respected them, at least enough to treat them well, and respect for those who are different, especially those who look different, is kind of at the heart of your book.
Absolutely. But remember, you know, he made money off of this. And it's not just people that look different. It was anybody that was different that would strike an imaginative, you know, I'll pay you a quarter kind of tone in people. And it was, you know, he displayed Indians. He just, anybody that was foreign looking.
Did he do the Hottentot?
He did, the Hottentot Venus. Oh, actually, I don't know if he did. I think, no, she was British.
Okay, yeah.
And the Hottentot Venus, just, you know, just as a reminder, was a woman who had extraordinarily large hindquarters and female parts, and was displayed as a result of, you know, of ownership, I guess. I don't know what else you'd say. And later on, her parts were literally cut off her and pickled.
Wow.
Which is kind of creepy. But.
It really horrifying. Well, talk about this fascination with freaks at that time. I mean, perhaps people still, and I use the word freaks not in a pejorative sense. I want that
Absolutely.
To be very clear.
Absolutely.
But is there something different about, and also tell us about this time, actually. Some of our listeners may not know exactly the time period we're talking about. So set us there and kind of give us a flavor of this time and why people would be so fascinated by this.
Well, it's 1865, and the museum that Barnum built was located in the lower part of Manhattan in New York City, although then the lower part was probably central. It was just after the Civil War, and President Lincoln had just been assassinated. So it was a very tense and extraordinary time. Tons of immigrants pouring into the city. There was already, there was already a clash of difference that I think may have fed somewhat into people's interest in seeing people outside the norm, and being able to look and stare and talk and touch and poke without negative ramification. But you know, I think people are always interested in the other. And, you know, I like to go back to say, you know, to think about what it feels like to be an other. I think we're fascinated with the other because, in some horrifying place inside of us, we are that person who is separate from everyone else. And, I think there's a kind of resonating connection there.
Is that something that's resonated for you?
Oh, of course. And I don't think I'm alone in that, but...
No, I don't think so.
No. And I think most creative people feel that strongly, but I don't think, I think it's something universal. And I like to say that, we've all been, in our first year in junior high school, walking down the hallway, and, we have on our sister's skirts, or if we're a boy, you know what I'm saying. We have on clothes that aren't quite fitting right, and we got a bit haircut, and we know we do, and everyone else looks gorgeous, and you're standing there, and you want to die, and I think that sense of separateness is so acute at different points in life for people, and especially when we're young and vulnerable to that.
I think you're right. Now, you mentioned creative people. You yourself have been a performer, a modern dancer.
I have. Mm-hmm.
Where did you practice your art?
Well, I'm a Midwesterner. I started in Cleveland. I worked in Boston and New York. I know dance is one of the other silent arts, much like writing is. I mean, it's something that you do that's both presented to the public, but it's an internal state. And I don't know where to go with that exactly, but, it's all of the arts are this combination of internal and external.
And how did you bring that sensibility to this book? And we're talking with Ellen Bryson about her debut novel, The Transformation of Bartholomew Fortunio.
Well, I think that there's something about presenting one's body without the capacity to explain it. and that you do in dance. I mean, you express, you dance choreographer steps, all of those things. But essentially, you're transmuting through the body, and you're sending whatever you can possibly send to an audience who looks at you. And there's something similar to me in that, and these characters who basically stand and they are perceived. They're, for example, Ael, the bearded woman. She has two shows. She has a private show, but her public show is when she's sitting on top of a dais above people, and she's she's dressed to the nines, in Victorian splendor. And she's the epitome of the proper woman, and she's rotating on top of this this dais for people to walk by and to look up at, as if she's a goddess. But she has a huge beard, and it's that presentation that there's only so much you can control, and yet you still are there for people to look at you physically.
Hmm. And also, it's curious. A bearded lady violates a sense of what is normal, and yet it seems to me that it can become quite normal. One can get quite used to the idea. I mean, I've looked at recently. I was looking at photographs of women who are bearded, and it didn't even seem that strange.
Well, certainly tattoos. I mean, some of the old freaks. It was the tattooed man or the tattooed woman, and that was considered absolutely aberrant. And all you have to do is go to a Bikram yoga class now, and you're realize how much tattoo art is part of our culture. So I don't know if that means that we're adjusting to the different more.
Right. I mean, the other thing is the fat lady. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, people who were what has become, regrettably, I'd say, the norm in many communities now was an object of wonder, awe, and derision.
Absolutely. It's amazing. But, there wasn't food like we have now, and there certainly wasn't bad food like we have now. So I don't know that's really interesting. I don't know if that means that we have a changing perception of beauty, although I still think that there's a big leap we have to take in order to perceive the truly obese as beautiful, but maybe not.
And some people have done it. In fact,
what I'm thinking.
I spoke with Leonard Nimoy, who is not just an actor, a movie star, but he's also a photographer, and he did a whole photograph of women who were very obese, and showed how beautiful they could be. So it is an interesting take. Now, I want to ask you a little bit about the research. You must have done an awful lot of research in order to write this book. Did you have any challenges?
Well, yeah, to stop researching. Research is wonderful. It's a wonderful thing to do. And once you start boring in, there's just so much to learn. Like I spent days on trying to understand. I was trying to think, do I need to put a chamber pot? Because every single little detail matters. Do I need to put a chamber pot underneath Fortuna's bed, were there outhouses in Manhattan? I mean, I didn't understand how that worked, and I had to study that where in the spectrum modern plumbing was at that point.
So where was it?
Well, I knew you were going to ask that. Well, it was changing. It was changing. But they had like these old wooden hollowed out trees underneath the street. So they had a kind of way to get rid of waste. But they were all rotten, and they would back up, or a raccoon would crawl in there and die. So it was quite a mess. And there really weren't indoor bathrooms yet. It was very, very, very rare.
You're saying they had hollowed out trees as kind of outhouses in the street?
No, not outhouses, as plumbing.
As plumbing?
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, I know. There's a part early in the book that talks about the plumbing on Ann Street backing up.
Huh. I can imagine that did that every time it flooded.
And baths, to take a bath was a rare occasion. So because there were not, you know, there were, you would have to share baths with people, and maybe once a week, maybe once every other week.
Wow. You also...
That's a ripe place.
What is it?
It must have been quite ripe.
Yeah, it must have been. Now, a lot of research that you put into this goes into the fire. And I have to tell our listeners that my interest was very piqued in this book just right at the outset before I even read it, because my mother lives, well, she has a loft in Soho. Mm-hmm. Between Spring and Prince, that building and the building, the sister building right next to it, mm-hmm. was P.T. Barnum's circus. Well, it was the replacement of the museum that you're talking about in this book. So there were actually two of them, and that building burned down as well, only after 2 years.
Yes, it did.
So I wonder if is there a suspicion of arson here?
Well, from what I read, nobody ever knew how. I mean, I've built a kind of suspicion of arson into the book, but nobody really knew who or what or why or how. And, you know, Barnum was politically involved to a point where perhaps it was his political rivals that burned down his museum. Nobody knows. And as far as the second one, although I will say it was very, very, very common. For these buildings to burn, then. I mean, you're talking open flame, and they're mostly wooden structures, and a lot of the theaters during those days burned down. So it wasn't that abnormal. It's just with Barnum, you know, with this big museum, it's just the at the end of the book is a truncated article from the Times about the burning of the museum, and the real article is quite long, and it's not funny. It's tragic, but it's funny also because of the animals leaping out of the windows and snakes slithering down the street. And it was quite dramatic.
So what role does this play, other than the fact that, of course, it happened? But how much can you tell us, basically, of the plot here without giving the story away?
The museum.
Yeah.
Wow, I mean, it's the world of the characters that the novel is about. I mean, they would not go back to being like a separate being. And here are a number of people who are so separated from their environment because of their physical attributes that they bond together in their own group, which is quite, I think, quite common and quite normal. And function as normal people function, with the same problems and love affairs and jealousies and angers and everything else everybody else has. But they do it in this very tight, closed environment. That and within this environment, they have the right and the privilege to see themselves as special rather than as people who would be humiliated if they were wandering around the street. I mean, what the museum does was enclose a world for these people in order that they could live a normal life.
Right. And then it burns down.
And then it burns down. It was very short-lived.
Yeah. Now, we haven't gotten to the central mystery or the transformation of Bartholomew Fortuno, who is the living skeleton, of course. He falls in love with the bearded lady. What can you tell us without giving away the story?
Well, I think, you know, if you think about the transformation, in some ways it could almost be a stretch to be considered a coming-of-age story. But here is a character who has great hardships and has defined himself not in a negative way because of those hardships, but in a positive way. And he was quite proud of his gift of being so thin that, in his words, he could show people what was literally inside of them. I mean, he felt he was a teacher and a giver back, and his transformation is the realization of how he was formed and why he was formed and who he really was. And it took the greater gifts of another being to wake him, and those greater gifts belong to the bearded woman. So it was kind of a love affair, but it's also an awakening, a tale of truth, of coming to find out who he really was.
And love is so often that, is awakens us to our true selves.
Whether we like it or not. Right? I mean, it's quite painful. It can be quite, quite painful.
Right. To be exposed.
To be exposed and to just be that. Any time that you open yourself up, I think, that much to another being, and, you know, you end up having to take back images of yourself that aren't part of your normal sense of being. And I think that's what can be painful. I mean, the good stuff is great, but, you know, when someone says, you know, you're really a crabby little horrible being sometimes, and, you know, you have to deal with that.
And, yes, and the loved one holds up the mirror to us.
That's right, the proverbial mirror, which can really not be nice, especially if the sun's shining and you haven't had any sleep.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, you're working on a new book, is that right?
I am. And you know what's odd is that it is, at least at this point, set in Amherst. It is.
In our neck of the woods here.
Absolutely. It's been, I started it last, I don't know, months ago, maybe 6 months ago. I have no idea why it's set in Amherst, but there she is.
Well, if you're going to set it in Amherst, you have to pronounce it correctly.
Oh, no. All right. How do I say it?
No H sound. Amherst.
Amherst. Amherst. Okay.
And it's a ghost story, is that right?
It's, you know, it's so early that it's, you know, I'm hesitant, but at this point it's about a woman who lives in New York, and she inherits a old house in the outskirts of Amherst. And as soon as she gets there, she starts hearing voices, and it's bouncing between the past and the present.
You know, what's interesting is that there is, on the Amherst Common, there is a very, very old hotel called the Lord Jeff, or Lord Jeffrey Hotel, which is named after Lord Jeffrey Amherst.
Mm-hmm.
And it is reputed to have ghosts in it.
Seriously?
Yes.
Fascinating.
Yeah, you might want to take a visit here, because it's quite well known for that. Many people have remarked upon them. And in fact, I first found out about it when one of the students who is at the station here, WMUA, did a report on it. She was in the newsroom that won an award, actually. So it's, yeah, quite an interesting story. So we've got a lot of ghosts around here.
I knew it.
Well, Ellen Bryson, your novel is the one that's published, not the one that's going to be, The Transformation of Bartholomew Fortuno. And thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, and thank you very much.
Ellen Bryson. She has yet to come out with her second novel, but you can read an excerpt from The Transformation of Bartholomew Fortuno by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.